You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole translators of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 181 by Rudolf Steiner, containing three cycles of lectures: Dying Earth and Living Cosmos, which is the title of the book technically, The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy, and The Need for New Forms of Consciousness. And I am on Lecture 10, which is the third of the seven lectures in the cycle, The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy, translated by Matthew Barton. Lecture 10 was given in Berlin on the 2nd of April, 1918. With the ideas I elaborated yesterday, I was especially keen to show the need at our current phase of evolution for new concepts, or at least ones that are not yet generally available, so that they can begin to inform our cultural horizons. Human culture requires certain ideas that are either not yet there or are not accessible. It is very important that this should happen. If we study the diverse aspects of modern culture, we find that despite all pride and arrogance that sometimes figures there, it has not produced any new ideas. Many diverse views exist in ethical, artistic, philosophical, or scientific disciplines, but they all, nevertheless, draw on old ideas that have been around a long time, which are then simply thrown together as if in a kaleidoscope and churned out again. We need new ideas. We lack precisely the kind of new ideas that we need. And this is why, for instance, certain ancient truths are no longer understood. Truths that surfaced among the ancients and have been passed down to us, ideas such as those figuring at the latest date in Plato or Aristotle. In still earlier times, such ideas were even more incisive. Nowadays, though, they are either not understood or rejected, because they are not understood. Let me give you an example of one such idea. When a person sees an object today, he thinks the object is outside him, and that he can see it due to the light that passively, one cannot say mysteriously, enters his eye from it, engendering what the soul senses as color, for instance. Plato has a different idea. Here we encounter something which, if we take it literally, we can only understand as meaning that the human eye, Iye, sends out something that mysteriously grasps hold of the object. It is as if the eyes extend feelers to grasp the object. This is what Plato writes. Modern scientific views cannot make anything of this, of course. It is an idea that you can find recorded in scholarly books on the history of philosophy, but you cannot make much headway with such books, because such ideas are based on something that existed in ancient times and has now faded. A certain atavistic clairvoyance or clairsentience. In our time, we need to rediscover this in a different way. Since ancient times, you see, ideas have been lost that we need to reacquire. They were lost in particular due to the Roman culture that poured across Europe, especially Western Europe. Proper study of this Roman culture in its spread across Europe would be very illuminating. We need to realize that there is nothing left now in Italy of this ancient Roman influence. And whatever else they may be responsible for, modern Italians have no part in what I am going to say. The spread of Roman culture through Europe had a really devastating and pulverizing effect on certain fundamental ideas, ones that now need to be brought back to life. We need think only, for instance, of the destruction of the town of Alesia shortly before Christ's birth. Situated in what is now the Core d'Or region of France, this center of ancient Celtic Gaelic culture, Celtic Gallic culture, was eradicated by the Romans. Napoleon III erected a monument to Vercingetorix at the site of this old town of Alesia, a center of ancient Celtic Druidic culture, which Caesar destroyed. It was a place of great learning. 10,000 Europeans studied there, in the way people studied in those times. All this was eradicated and replaced by Roman culture. This is merely an historical observation, which can show that in Europe, too, influential ideas of a more ancient kind existed in ancient cultural centers and were eradicated. Today, I chiefly want to focus on two ideas that need to be incorporated into scientific inquiry and life in general if a better understanding of the world is to arise. The first is to understand how we really perceive the world with our senses, which happens in the following way. Whenever we see a colored object before us, while it is true that this acts upon us, there is also a process of destruction at work in the human organism, intervening between ourselves and the colored object. I have often described this. A kind of small death occurs with our nervous system as the organ for ongoing breakdown processes. The blood, however, balances and counteracts these destructive processes caused by the outer world impinging upon our organism. In the human organism, there is a mutual interaction continually at work between blood and nerve, and this interplay involves an enlivening process from the blood, on the one hand, and a kind of death process from the nervous system on the other. As we perceive a colored object in the external world, and this impinges on us, a process of destruction takes place in our neural system. Something is destroyed both in the physical body and in the ether body. A kind of channel is bored through our organism due to a process of destruction that runs in a quite specific direction. When we see something, a channel is bored from our eye to our brain. Rather than something dissolving its way through from the brain to the eye, it is the opposite. A hole is bored, and through this the astral body slips in order to be able to see whatever the object is. Plato still knew this. It could be seen by ancient atavistic clairvoyants. And we will have to reacquire such knowledge by really getting to know the human organism again through modern clairvoyance, discovering this channel that arises, this hole where a tunnel is bored from the eye to the brain, by means of which the capital I unites with what impinges from without. Humanity has to learn to form different concepts from those common today in modern epistemology or physiology. Instead, seeing that a channel or tunnel is bored from the eye, EYE, to the brain, and through this the astral body and capital I connect and engage with the outer world. This is alien to modern ideas. And therefore people are likewise unaware of the physiological factors that follow from this. Nowadays, students at university learn all the received wisdom about physiology, but never anything about how things are in reality. What they learn is meaningless. Another such concept is one you commonly find today in modern academic discourse. Human development is described there in these terms. We are born as undeveloped creatures, and then our psyche and mind slowly develop, coming to expression slowly through our organism as it grows more complex and refined. This view appears everywhere today amongst psychologists and academics in general, and also in books for the general public. People can relate to this idea, which seems highly probable, but it is only but it is all only appearance, maya. In many respects, this is actually the opposite of the truth, the opposite of what really occurs. Instead, and here I need only refer you to what I described entitled The Education of the Child, though expressed in a slightly different way there, we should understand that in infancy, the soul and spirit are still of the nature of soul and spirit. And as the child develops, these gradually transform into material configuration, into the body. Gradually, a person becomes a full picture or reflection of soul and spirit. It is very important to have this insight. If we have it, we will no longer regard what runs around on two legs on the ground as the human being, in quotes, but we'll see that this is a reflection or image of the human being. And that when we are born in supersensible terms, we gradually grow together with the body and create a full image or reflection of soul and spirit. Soul and spirit vanish into the body and manifest less and less in their own right. In other words, we need the very opposite idea from the one commonly regarded as true. We need to know that we become, say, 20 years old by virtue of the spirit descending into and being subsumed by the body, the spirit transforming into the body, since the body itself is an external image of the spirit. Then we will also see that gradually as we age, a reverse transformation occurs. The body calcifies and hardens, but the spirit becomes ever more soul-spiritual in nature. We cannot hold fast to it, however, because it is at odds with the physical world and seeks to express itself through the physical body. The spirit becomes ever more autonomous and only comes to full manifestation after death. So you see, it is not that the spirit and soul gradually wane and grow dull as we age, but the opposite. They become ever freer again. Naturally, a materialistic thinker, faced with this idea, will very often object that Kant, for example, a very clever man, lost his faculties when old. And so it can scarcely be true to say that spirit and soul were emancipating themselves. But such objections are made only because a materialist cannot perceive or take any account of the spirit and soul that has gradually grown into the world of spirit. It will be a hard nut for many to crack, to think that as we grow older we do not actually grow feeble-minded, but more spiritual. It is just that the body has worn out, and the soul and spirit we have developed cannot be expressed through the body any more. It is like a piano player who might go on and on developing his skills, but if the piano is worn out and broken, it will be hard to discern this. You won't perceive much of his skills if the piano is out of tune and there are several strings missing. In old age, Kant, though apparently feeble-minded, had actually become glorious for the world of spirit. To discover reality, we sometimes have to turn received wisdom on its head. We have to give real credence to the view that what is at work in the world in this respect is maya, a grand illusion. If we become aware of this great illusion of maya, we will start to be able to properly acknowledge that the appearance of weakness and feeble-mindedness in outer physical terms in a person 70 years of age is deceptive, and that his spirit is just elsewhere than on the physical plane. Obstacles to understanding spiritual science often consist in our inability to form appropriate ideas about what happens on the ordinary physical plane. We form erroneous ideas about what happens here, and these mistaken concepts sunder us from reality, prevent us reaching it. But if we develop concepts such as the one I just described, we will come much closer to the knowledge which spiritual scientific research discovers in relation to what happens immediately after death. Entering into physical life at birth, we gradually and increasingly come into relationship with our physical body. You have now heard the right way to view this relationship. There is always so much to say that sometimes we fail to consider the fact that something similar also occurs between death and rebirth. Here we likewise engage in a relationship with something that resembles our increasing connection with the physical body here on earth. Our physical corporeality is not merely physical corporeality, but as we know it encompasses the physical body, the etheric body or body of formative forces, and the astral body or outward soul, the soul body. Just as in physical life here, we have to appropriate these three vessels or aspects, we likewise have to appropriate three vessels in the time between death and a following rebirth. To ensure these are not confused with anything else, I will name them here. They are the soul human, soul life or life soul, and the soul self. In the same way that we here appropriate the physical body for life in the physical world, so after death we appropriate the soul human. And likewise, the life soul corresponds to the ether body or body of formative forces, and the soul self or individual soul corresponds to the astral or soul body we acquire here. I have chosen these terms so that they are not confused with what humankind will acquire in a different way in the Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan stages of evolution, which will be similar, but since a different phase of existence is involved there, has to be distinguished carefully. The terms themselves do not matter. What we need to do is inquire a little into how these vessels are appropriated after death. After entering upon the life that unfolds between death and rebirth, we are, initially, surrounded by a composite of pictures that originate in our experiences during the life that has just ended, or also from still earlier experiences. But for now, let us stay with the experiences of our previous life, which arise for us as pictures surrounding us. It is important to realize that these pictures are in our surroundings after death, and remarkably, that we find it somewhat difficult to realize they belong to us. What I described entitled Theosophy as our experiences in the soul world, a recapitulation of our life in pictures, is only a part of this whole world of pictures. Apart from those, there are others. And our life after death involves gradual recognition that these images belong to us. Our consciousness engages with these pictures in order to recognize in the right way that they belong to us. We can only fully understand what this involves if we realize that our life here, between birth and death, is far richer than only our conscious life. We live in certain conditions and relationships, in community with certain other people. What happens between us and plays a conscious part in our lives is only a part of this. Things continually occur. You have to recognize that we are consciously aware only of a small part of what we experience in our life unfolding here on earth. Let us take an ordinary event. You have gathered here this evening, and every person here has therefore entered into some kind of interaction with every other. But if you try to discern how much of these interrelationships you are conscious of, it will be very little. If you are at a distance of 3 meters from someone and then approach him, this approach involves a whole sum of facial expressions. How you see a person's face changes continually as you come closer to him. Our ordinary physical reason cannot possibly trace in thought everything we actually experience during physical life. What we consciously experience is only a small portion, and what remains subconscious is far more significant. When you read a letter, for instance, you are usually aware of its content, but much more is going on in the depths of your soul. Without being aware of it, you are mildly annoyed or gladdened by the beautiful or ugly handwriting. But more than this, something of the writer actually enters into you, without you being aware of this, with every letter of his handwriting. This lives in you like a dream, continually infusing your life. This is why we find it so difficult to really understand dreams, because they manifest a great deal of what we overlook in our ordinary awareness. Assume that one lady is sitting here, and over there another. If the attention of one of them is not drawn to the fact that another lady is sitting over there, she does not observe her more closely. She can fail entirely to become aware of her gestures and whatever else she does. Yet this takes root in the subconscious. And what we paid scarcely any attention to in waking life can enter our dreams. Or, imagine you are wrapped in your own thoughts when a friend passes you by without you noticing him at all, perhaps. And then you dream of him, despite being unaware that you passed him in the street. A very great deal occurs in life, and so little of it enters our waking consciousness. Yet all these manifold occurrences in life that remain in our subconscious become images around us. Coming here tonight and going away again later, the image of this whole room will stay with you, although only in so far as it has all made some kind of impression on your soul. There are no demarcated boundaries where soul impressions are concerned. Human life is therefore associated with the creation of countless pictures and images. All of them, I can think of no other expression, are rolled up in human life. And the first thing that happens after death is the unfurling of these pictures, as one could call it, the unrolling of pictures of post-mortem imaginations. Around the human soul, a world of imaginations gradually forms, and our consciousness then consists of our perception of this world of pictures. I described this from a somewhat different perspective in my Vienna lectures on life between death and rebirth. It is important to consider these things from various different angles. This unfurling of images can be compared in a way with what happens when we are young children, have just been born, when our body is as yet largely unformed. People other than mothers sometimes think an infant resembles a frog, not yet fully human. It gradually takes shape and form. And just as we gradually assume clearer form as we grow older, so that something we bear within us becomes materially manifest, so in the same way a life grows after death that we can describe as the unfurling of images of our life. In this unfurling or unrolling, the aspect of our nature we call the soul human assumes form. You have to picture that what exists of us after death is spread out, and that in the imaginations of our past life, the soul human initially grows, the human being of images, the developing spirit corporeality consisting of imaginations. Here again we can offer enormous help to the dead if we accompany them with such ideas, which are at the same time those of spiritual science, or such images as we elaborated yesterday of the bluish-purple earth with the golden Jerusalem. These are pictures that the dead soul longs for he thirsts for orienting and ordering imaginations. This gives him real support and help. We help him especially if we accompany him with thoughts of what we have experienced with him as a point of reference for this unfurling of images. It is especially beneficial if we accompany him with thoughts of things in life that were scarcely noticed at the time. Picture, for instance, if you can recall it, how a person entered the house on his return from work, how you welcomed him, and the soul quality coming to expression in this greeting. Such things can contain an infinitely loving quality, though also other quite different qualities too, of course. In doing this, you will meet the dead person in thought. I have described all kinds of ways in which we can mingle our own thoughts with this world of pictures within which the dead soul has to develop, within which his consciousness has to spread and unfurl. Ideas which the dead soul strove for, but was unable to attain fully, and that explain something to him, become his world of pictures. And here we can help him, collaborate with him in forming his soul human aspect. In the period following death, of course, the other aspects are also present and developing, the soul life, or life soul, and also the soul self. These aspects, in particular, develop increasingly and assume increasing definition, so that the dead soul, immediately after death, feels them to be future potential in him, something he only slowly develops. In this respect, the dead person has the sense that he has to elaborate the soul human, has to work to develop it, but that the life soul is something he must just allow to develop, which emerges gradually of itself. It is, of course, already present, just as the power of reason is innate in a child, but, like this too, it has to develop gradually. Immediately after death, an inspiring power arises in the dead soul in consequence, and develops to become ever stronger. If we help the dead soul, as described, we also help him to develop this inspiring power. You see, something must gradually come to speak to the dead soul from these pictures. They have to become more than a mere memory of the life that has passed, must convey something new to him that life was not yet able to convey to him. What they now tell him must become the seed or germ of what he shapes as his next life on earth. Thus the life soul begins to develop, and the pictures become ever more eloquent. Initially, the dead person directs his gaze, if I can put it like that, to the earth primarily. Just as we direct our thoughts upward to the world of spirit, so the dead person always orients his soul to the earth. For instance, he sees, as I described yesterday, an earth globe whose eastern hemisphere is bluish, and whose western hemisphere is reddish in color. These pictures appear and are interwoven with him. Within the general picture of the earth, he initially sees his own life, his life with us on earth. And this is also why we can help him to make sense of these pictures. He has departed from the earth, but does not yet leave it with his eye of soul. And gradually the earth starts to resound for him, as inspiration increasingly develops. The pictures he sees gradually tell him more and more. People often ask me whether this help given to the dead can only be given soon after death, or whether one can still offer it years or decades later. The need for such help never ends. No one can live so long on the earth that it becomes unnecessary to help someone who has died before him. Even if someone has been dead for 30 or 40 years, the karmic connection remains. Of course, we should remember, though, that if the soul of the person still alive on earth is less developed, he will have a more vivid awareness of his connection with the dead soul to begin with. It can be felt very strongly to start with, since the pictures then still arise more passively in the dead soul, and mostly relate to what he did on earth. Then these pictures start to resound. The music of the spheres sounds forth from them. This is harder for those on earth to relate to, and we can only gain insight into it through spiritual science, by knowing what will happen in future epochs of the earth. But after all, it is not very common for people to feel the need to come close to the dead person over decades, compared with their feelings immediately after his death. Experience shows that as living people we grow less and less attached to the dead, and our living feeling for them fades. And this is at least partly why our connection with the dead becomes less strongly felt as time passes. This can show us that the first period of life between death and rebirth is primarily given up to developing the soul human, to what hovers round us as a world of imaginations. Later on, though this also exists from the beginning, we turn our attention to the inspiring power of the soul, to the life soul. And then the soul self also stands before the dead soul like an ideal. This too is present from the outset, since it is what gives us individual consciousness. Just as the power of reason needs to develop through childhood, although it exists innately from the beginning, so between death and rebirth, we develop the soul self. To a very large degree, it is developed in the period during which we gradually approach a new life on earth again. When we start blooming with spiritual youth in the period between death and rebirth, our soul self has reached the culmination of its development. On earth we gradually age, whereas in the world of spirit, between death and rebirth, we grow young again. Here we grow gray with age, and there we grow ever more youthful. Not so very long ago, people knew such things. One need only remember the phrase in Goethe's Faust, quote, grown young in the misty age, close quote, which refers to being born in the northern world. In the old days, people did not speak of being born, but of becoming young, and this referred to a person's life before birth. Goethe picked up on this expression. In the last period of the time between death and rebirth, the soul therefore chiefly develops the power of intuition. In the first period, the imaginative aspect of the soul came alive, that is, the soul human. Then the inspired aspect of the soul, the life soul, gradually emerges to its full extent. And following this, there develops what gives the soul its full individuality, the capacity of intuition, the ability to find one's way into other realities. What does the soul find its way into here? Of what does it chiefly receive intuitions? At a certain point in the life between death and rebirth, the soul starts to feel an affinity with a succession of generations that eventually leads to a father and mother for the next life. The soul gradually develops this affinity with ancestors who marry, to their children, and so on. Immediately after death, we experience the pictures as these unfurl. We look down upon earth, and these pictures together compose greater pictorial contexts in the imaginative realm. When we are approaching a new life on earth again, we become ever more intuitive. And here we have a broader, more all-encompassing picture as I described it yesterday. The earth's sphere shimmering blue across Asia, India, East Africa, and glittering red in the other hemisphere where America lies, with green and other color tones between these two areas. And now the earth also resounds in a wealth of tones, the melodies, harmonies, and choirs of the music of the spheres. Gradually this is interfused with the pictures one had previously of the generational line of descent. Gradually we come to discern the 36th, then the 35th pair of ancestors, the 34th, the 33rd, the 32nd, and so on down to one's future mother and father. We come to discern this, interwoven into our imaginations, informed by intuition, until we arrive at our mother and father. This intuition is really a process of being subsumed in what lives in the line of descent. Thus, the second half of our life, between death and rebirth, is one in which we accustom ourselves to live ever more fully in what is occurring below, to live in this otherness already in a prefiguring way, in what will become both our closer and further surroundings, Instead of living in ourselves now, we live in what is other than us. We embark on the life between death and new birth by living in what is other than us, and come to the end of it by primarily also being able to live in what is other. Then we are born, and initially retain something of this otherness. This is why we are imitators in our first 7 years. We imitate everything we perceive. Read what I presented entitled The Education of the Child in the Light of Spiritual Science. This imitation is a last echo of living in what is other than us, which continues into our physical life. This is the primary quality, understood spiritually, in the life between death and rebirth, and likewise the first characteristic that emerges in the young child, imitation of what is around us. We will fail to understand the capacity for imitation in the child if we do not know that it originates in the grandiose, intuitive life of soul and spirit in the latter period of our life between death and rebirth. Here again we have an idea that will be important for future spiritual development to encompass. In ancient times, primarily by virtue of knowing the spirit through atavistic clairvoyance, direct vision instilled a belief in immortality, which people now regard as very dubious if they think materialistically. In former times they had knowledge of it. But in future the idea of immortality will be invoked from the opposite direction. People will come to see that this life here on earth is the continuation of a life of spirit. In the same way that people used to regard a continuation of life after death as self-evident, in future they will increasingly come to see all life here as a continuation of the life between death and rebirth. The churches have all put obstacles in the way of this insight into the pre-existence of the soul, which they consider heretical. As we know, the Church Father Origen had a poor reputation, particularly because he still recognized this truth. In the 9th century, as I have said before, the Ecumenical Council of Constantinople, in quotes, abolished the spirit by establishing the dogma that human beings consist only of body and soul, without spirit, though they accorded the soul some spiritual quality. The council prohibited people from regarding the human being as constituted of body, soul, and spirit. Naturally, this prohibition still remains, but something else has become associated with it. Our, quote, unprejudiced science, close quote, has adopted this schema. It is very interesting. Modern philosophers commonly divide human nature into body and psyche, and very rarely is there any mention of a threefold body, soul, and spirit. If you read the renowned philosopher and psychologist Wundt, you can find that such, quote, unprejudiced empiricism, close quote, divides human nature into body and soul alone. But it is not unprejudiced. It is the last vestige of the dogma established by the 8th Ecumenical Council. Philosophers have forgotten this and regard their inquiries as unprejudiced. So here we have one obstacle, the abolition of the spirit. The other barrier erected by the Church is its forbidding of the belief in the soul's pre-existence. Even unprejudiced people cannot countenance this belief in pre-existence. There was a famous philosopher-theologian, or theological philosopher, whichever way round you like, called Froschammer, in Munich, who attacked the idea of the soul's pre-existence by saying this: if the soul really existed before birth, and was not born at the same time as the body, the child's parents would engender a little animal, which then acquired a soul. He thought this a very worrying idea. I cited it in notes to my title, Riddles of the Soul. But that is not how it is either. If we know that the soul connects with a bloodline for over 30 generations before birth, we cannot say that the parents conceive a little animal. There was a whole spiritual process involved, running through more than 30 generations. In future, therefore, we will not ask whether this life continues beyond death, but by a proper study of physical life on earth, we'll come to see that our physical life, beginning at birth, is a continuation of a life of spirit. People will recognize that spiritual life continues into mortal life, and mortal life into immortal life. And by discerning the one within the other, they will then have a sure basis for studying immortality. When people come to understand this life on earth in the right way, they will cease to try to understand it solely in terms of physical existence, but will inevitably acquire other ideas in addition, such as those I have now described. Oh, there are a great many ideas that need to be corrected. Ideas that hold true in life are often very hard to acquire, and modern vernacular can be a great obstacle here. We have to use popular language initially, because otherwise no one will understand us. But it is very problematic to think that a child acquires his resemblance to his parents by direct inheritance. That is nonsense. In the public lecture, I also said that our mainstream scientists struggle a great deal by failing to apply to the organic realm what is self-evident in inorganic science. No one would dream of explaining magnetic force by saying that it resides in a piece of iron itself, a horseshoe, say. Magnetism in a magnet or in a magnetic needle is explained in relation to the magnetic poles of the earth. But when an egg forms in a chicken or a human embryo develops, people stop looking further afield for an explanation. And yet the cosmos is everywhere involved in such processes. However strange it seems, in the same way that in visual perception a channel is bored into the eye, EYE, to open a passage for the eye capital and allow it to emerge, reproduction is founded on the fact that space is created. The mother's organism is prepared in a way that creates space there. And what then develops enters from the cosmos, from the whole macrocosm. It is a complex process, but a space is created in the mother. The mother's organism is interrupted to create a cavity where the macrocosmic powers can enter. That is the important thing, and before long even mainstream embryology will come to see this, understanding that the most important part of the embryo is where there is nothing, where the matter constituting the mother is repulsed to allow the macrocosm to enter. This macrocosmic element is long prepared, the human soul intuitively accompanying ancestors of its future body for at most 32 to 35 generations. The soul is already connected with these powers working in from the cosmos, can already perceive them. From the zodiac realm he is assigned to, he watches the macrocosmic ray fall upon earth and observes where he will be incarnated, and then he gradually approaches the earth. These things, I believe, can also make an important impression on our sensibility. One cannot assimilate spiritual science in the same way as, say, mathematics. We have to unite our heart and mind deeply with it, and in reality this makes us into a different person, profoundly enriching human life and creating the foundation for a really cosmic consciousness. This enlivening effect of spiritual scientific perception, refreshing in the best sense of the word, is of key importance. At the same time, we should be aware that in the current age we find ourselves in a kind of transitional period in relation to these things. And this is the karma of our era, must take upon itself. People tend to object to assimilating what they consider very complex ideas in order to engage with an anthroposophic view of human destiny. Others, they say, make things plainer and simpler. Certainly, someone like Dr. Johannes Müller makes things nice and simple. But the point is that we are living in a period of transition, and that these ideas are still unaccustomed ones in our day and age. We must accustom ourselves to them. The time will inevitably come when children already are taught such things, though in a suitable form. This will be possible, and in doing so, people will discover that children will understand them surprisingly well. Much better than others, they will understand what is drawn from the pictures spiritual science presents. You see, they bring with them, as capacity of imitation they possess in the world of spirit, diverse qualities which we then expunge from their souls, which we fail to acknowledge, sometimes quite brutally dismissing them. Otherwise, people would admit that some children say remarkably intelligent things, can often be far more insightful than adults. What a child says can sometimes be far more interesting, more closely connected to the real nature of the world, than what a university professor says. The insights of spiritual science need to be assimilated with a certain sensibility, a certain ethos, and then it will not be difficult to present them to children in a fitting way. Naturally, this can feel uncomfortable initially, which is why people dismiss such things. But if we really attend to the place children's questions are coming from, their timbre, we will see that they possess recollections of another life. We have to give serious credence to spiritual science, seeing that it must also find its way into the life of society, to which upbringing and education likewise belong. A great deal more could be done in this respect than is usually thought possible. Nowadays, prospective teachers are tested to see primarily what knowledge they have, although this is the thing least necessary to their profession. Whatever they need for their teaching can always be read up somewhere, and whatever one studies and learns for exams is always swiftly forgotten. You can see what I mean if I recount an anecdote from my own college days. I was due to be examined, but the professor in question was ill at the time. I went to the assistant professor, and he told me that I would have to wait a week to be examined, and expressed his sympathy for my condition, which he likened to that of a pregnant woman. He said, "Could I know what it's like? You will have forgotten it all in a week, but I'm sorry, there's nothing to be done." Close quote. It is therefore common knowledge that all one is supposed to have learned for an exam will be forgotten soon afterward. It is really very comical. The important thing in a teacher, instead, is to see what kind of person is being unleashed on our children. Instead of focusing on what a person has crammed into the mechanism of his memory and thinking, we should look for the human being in him. The real human being is what counts in teaching. Someone who is capable of creating the imponderable relationship with young people that is so necessary. It will then be an easy matter to present to children and young people the aspects of spiritual science that can benefit them. Today I chiefly wanted to draw your attention to realities at work in all human life, to show that the old concepts are not enough, that we need new ones to enrich our view of the world. When spiritual science is disseminated more widely, you will see what kind of response it meets with in many quarters. People have been longing for something like it for a long time. Most people dislike absorbing too many ideas at once, which is why they like going to slideshows or illustrated presentations, where they can simply stare rather than absorbing new ideas. Whenever something new is presented to people, they usually wonder what on earth the speaker is going on about, and wish he would translate what he is saying into terms that they are already familiar with. This is not what we are doing in the science of the spirit, where new ideas and concepts are needed, ones that do not yet exist. Some of them existed in olden times in different forms, but have not yet reappeared in a modern form. We have to resolve to penetrate new ideas, and this is often very difficult for people. If they really did so, they would not object so vociferously, but would really attend to such ideas and assimilate them. Instead of asking what on earth an anthroposophical speaker is going on about, they would realize that such views we form also release life forces in us and enable us to enter into reality. They would see that spiritual vision, though subtle, is something much closer to them than they think. But prejudices will have to be overcome for them to get to that point. There is, for instance, a popular little book entitled Introduction to Philosophy, expounding concepts such as those I described today and yesterday as inadequate. The author enters especially strange territory when he speaks of, quote, supernaturalism, close quote, his word for the supersensible. He regards this idea as particularly harmful because, he says, the natural realm is one where we can all form and test our own views, whereas in the supersensible realm, the supernatural, there is a danger that people cannot judge things for themselves, but must take things on the authority of others. This is, of course, connected with another idea, that in all ages priests have exploited such power to make people dependent on their authority. But if we consider the actual circumstances, we find that mainstream philosophers actually become rather childish when they start speaking of the supersensible. This is childish or childlike. This is a childish or childlike view. For it seems the author here has no idea that the belief in authority still remains very prevalent today, however much people wish to distance themselves from it. How many people actually know, for instance, what the teachings of Copernicus are based on? These ideas are presented to them as if a person were given a chair to sit on out in the cosmos somewhere and shown the motions of the sun with the planets circling round it. But all this is nonsense. If people were shown all that could really be disclosed to them, they would form a quite different idea of things and would come to see how unsound all these hypotheses are. Consider the huge scope of what people today simply take on authority. In another area, though this is a related phenomenon, people are very pleased when a Bolshevik government discloses to the public secret files upon which the fate of countless people depend. Here is a natural fact that all can check. But in relation to the supersensible, they think people will lose their independence. This is to turn things on their head. And one task of spiritual science will be to put things the right way up again. It is inevitable that things have been turned upside down, for the consciousness soul needed to develop. But now it is time to set things the right way up again. We will pick up on this again next time, and we'll see that this picture of setting things the right way up, standing them on their legs again, actually also has a deeper reality. The end of Lecture 10.